Welcome to CME on ReachMD. This segment, entitled Colorectal Cancer, Integrating the Latest Advances into Clinical Practice, Data and Expert Insights from the 2016 Meeting on Gastrointestinal Cancers in San Francisco, is jointly provided by the Postgraduate Institute for Medicine and Access Medical Education. Prior to beginning the activity, please be sure to review the faculty information and conflict of interest disclosure statements, as well as the learning objectives by visiting this activity on reachmd.com/CME on your computer, smartphone, or tablet device.
Welcome to the CME CE certified activity entitled Integrating the Latest Advances into Clinical Practice, Data and Expert Insights from the 2016 Meeting on Gastrointestinal Cancers in San Francisco. This educational activity is jointly provided by the Postgraduate Institute for Medicine and Access Medical Education and is supported by educational grants from Novartis Pharmaceuticals, Taiho Oncology Incorporated, and Lilly. My name is Dr. J. Randolph Hecht. I'm a professor of clinical medicine and Carol and Saul Rosenzweig Chair for Cancer Therapies Development, as well as director of the UCLA GI Oncology Program at the UCLA School of Medicine in Los Angeles, California. My disclosures include consulting fees for Amgen, Boston Biomedical, and Genentech. Our discussion today will include the most exciting and compelling data in colorectal cancer from the 2016 Gastrointestinal Cancers Meeting, as well as insights on how these clinical advances may be practice-changing. So let's begin. The first study I'd like to highlight is the STEAM trial, which was presented by Joanna Bendel. Now, this trial, which was entitled Overall Response Rate in STEAM, this was a randomized trial, open label, phase two, of three different arms. This was based on data from Dr. Falcone and his Italian group, looking at combining all three active cytotoxic agents in colorectal cancer, 5-FU, irinotecan, and oxaliplatin, which is called FOLFOXIRI. And he has looked at this over a number of years, either alone or in combination with biological agents, and shown that this combination actually has led to improved survival. Now, more recently, he combined this with the standard biological agent bevacizumab, and this was the TRIBE trial. So this was FOLFOXIRI plus bevacizumab, and it was compared in that trial to FOLFIRI plus bevacizumab, and there was an improvement that he's seen in outcomes. So this trial, the STEAM trial, was looking at FOLFOXIRI actually given two different ways, which I'll discuss in a minute, versus a regimen which would be more standard in the United States, which is FOLFOX plus bevacizumab. Now, I think there's been a lot of controversy as to whether or not, one, these patients can tolerate the combination of all three cytotoxics, or whether or not it's better to just do doublets rather than a triplet. The other question has been, since patients who fail first-line therapy usually get second-line therapy, why would throwing everything in the entire kitchen sink at the beginning work? And I think there's some interesting data that's come out of the previous trials that a higher percentage of people fall off between first-line and second-line than we realize, and that only about two-thirds of patients who get first-line therapy get second-line therapy. So that's a potential reason why giving everything up front may be, beneficial. So what Dr. Bendel looked at was what she called concurrent FOLFOXIRI Bev, and that would be considered to be the standard very similar to what Dr. Falcone had said. The other arm that she looked at was alternating FOLFOX and FOLFIRI, which she called sequential FOLFOXIRI Bev. And finally, the control arm, remember this was a randomized phase two, was FOLFOX plus bevacizumab. The patients were treated for a total of 4 months. This was an induction phase. This is what we normally would do with these drugs, particularly with an oxaliplatin-containing regimen. And then patients went to a maintenance phase where they could receive either 5-FU plus leucovorin plus bevacizumab or capecitabine plus bevacizumab. if once patients progressed, then they went to second line therapy, which was generally a fluoropyrimidine-based chemotherapy investigator's choice. And the endpoints that were looked at in this trial were investigator-assessed response rate in the first-line therapy, as well as PFS1, which is basically from the time that the patient started till they progressed, which is usually on maintenance therapy. So the arms were fairly well balanced between the three arms. It's a relatively small trial, only about 300 patients, so much smaller than a lot of the large randomized trials that people, you know, are used to looking at, like 80405, or some of the other some of the other large recent trials. But what they showed was that there was an increased response rate in either of the FOLFOXIRI arms, between 60% and 62%, versus slightly under 50% with the FOLFOX bevacizumab arm. The question, of course, that comes up with this is whether or not this is, you know, how important is response rate, and there probably are times where this may be important, particularly if you're trying to get someone to surgery or someone has very rapidly growing disease, but in general, response rate is only so useful as an endpoint. Now, the other thing that Dr. Bendel showed was that there was an improvement in PFS1, which is what we would normally do, progression-free survival. So median progression-free survival in the FOLFOXIRI arms was 11.4 months versus 9.3 months in the FOLFOX plus bevacizumab arm. This was a hazard ratio of about 0.7. So, you know, the question is really what to make of this large randomized phase 2 trial. Well, one is that in American hands, that the combination of all three drugs together was actually relatively well tolerated, which is what had been seen in the Italian trials. Two, it also showed that the response rate, not surprisingly, was higher compared to what would be considered a more standard regimen of FOLFOX plus bevacizumab. The other thing that it showed, at least right now, was that the alternating FOLFOX and FOLFIRI looked similar to the FOLFOXIRI, but you know, I don't think there's enough patients really necessarily to recommend this. On the downside, of course, is not surprisingly, there were, even though it was well tolerated, there were more grade 3 events and you know, on this. And so I think, at least right now, I think this is very interesting, but I can't say that this is something that I would necessarily would want to do. So with this combination, I think that the most likely scenario that I could foresee someone using this would be, once again, in someone who really needs a response because they have a large burden of disease, and you're, though, a relatively good performance status and you're concerned about the patient falling off the cliff. Occasionally we will use this, particularly in young patients who are candidates for liver resection, but there's a large bulky disease and shrinking the tumor down would be helpful. There was some data from the TRIBE trial, the Italian trial. The numbers were small that in patients with BRAF mutant colon cancer, which is up to 10%, and those patients tend to do very poorly, that in those patients, the combination of all three drugs seemed to do better. Though the numbers were small, and we'd love to see what happens in the BRAF mutant patients in the STEAM trial. So let's leave that and go to the other trial, large randomized trial that was presented recently. And this was the so-called MAVERICK trial. And the background for MAVERICK is that a number of groups, including Heinz-Joseph Lenz, who was the first author on this, have been looking at biomarkers not just for targeted therapies, but also for cytotoxic agents. And this really goes back for several decades. In particular, what they've looked at has been TS, or thymidylate synthase, for fluoropyrimidines, which has never really panned out. And the other biomarker that's been looked at, not just in colorectal cancer, but also in gastric as well as other cancers, has been ERCC, which may predict for response or lack of response to platinum-based agents. So this trial, which was a phase 2 trial, and this was looking at modified FOLFOX6 plus bevacizumab, and patients were randomized 1-to-1 versus FOLFIRI plus bevacizumab. Now, the thing that was interesting was is that patients were analyzed, their tumor was analyzed specifically for ERCC1, and this was a relatively large trial, but they used ERCC1 as a stratification criteria. There were almost 400 patients in the trial. And so, in effect, this was a trial that was looking, the patients were not assigned as per ERCC1, but instead it was stratified. The other thing that's interesting about this trial is that it's really one of the largest, if not the largest trial, that directly compared in first-line metastatic colorectal cancer an oxaliplatin-containing regimen versus FOLFIRI. The other caveat, of course, both arms, this being a modern trial, received bevacizumab. So the endpoints that they had looked at were progression-free survival by treatment group. And there were two endpoints that I think that were particularly interesting. One is that when you looked at patients who had high, and they have a specific biomarker that Dr. Lentz has been working on for at least 15 years, and it's changed over time, but they used their own pre-specified biomarker for ERCC1. And when you looked at that, it didn't really matter whether the patient received an oxaliplatin-containing regimen or irinotecan. So there were some small differences, none of which were statistically significant. The other thing that was interesting, particularly with this trial, was this was the largest single trial, really comparing oxaliplatin versus irinotecan. And a number of centers around the country use irinotecan frontline. In the United States, the majority of patients who have not received oxaliplatin in the adjuvant setting get an oxaliplatin-based regimen up front. While in Europe, it's actually closer to 50-50. But in this trial, even though it was really not necessarily designed for this, is that there appeared to be a longer progression-free survival, and this was not statistically significant, and perhaps even an overall survival with patients who received FOLFIRI bevacizumab versus modified FOLFOX6 plus bevacizumab. So now let's next go to rectal cancer. So rectal cancer is different than colon cancer in a number of different ways. In the metastatic setting, we tend to treat them the same. Under the microscope, they look very similar. But the treatment, particularly of early rectal cancer, is different because the surgery is more difficult. The surgery is potentially mutilating in patients who end up having an abdominal perineal resection. And because the local recurrence rate is higher, we tend to use radiation. Now, over the last several decades, there really has been a significant improvement in the surgery for rectal cancer and the widespread adoption of total mesorectal excision, or TME, has significantly reduced the risk of local recurrence, which is one of the things that's feared. Locally recurrent rectal cancer can sometimes be salvaged, but it really is a terrible thing. It's a terrible problem, and someone that you can't salvage, it can be a terrible and painful way to die. Now, based on British and European data, total mesorectal excision has become the standard, and local recurrence rates are actually fairly low, usually in the 5% or so range. Unfortunately, in the United States, I have to be honest that not every patient ends up getting total mesorectal excision. Now, also for the last several decades, radiation has been a part of the treatment of rectal cancer. And initially, it was given postoperatively based on the German Zauer trial that most patients who get radiation actually get it preoperatively, which has a number of potential advantages. It seems to be less toxicity. There's an increased chance of sphincter sparing due to downstaging. Patients did at least as well, if not slightly better. So in Europe, While we've been giving, in Europe, they've been giving radiation in a different fashion than we do in the United States, particularly in Scandinavia. In the United States, we tend to give long course, which is usually about 5 to 6 weeks of radiation, 50.4 grays over 28 fractions. However, in Scandinavia, there was a tendency to give 5 large fractions right before surgery. That's convenient, it's less expensive, but it doesn't allow for downstaging. So what I'm going to present now is the Polish trial, which Buczko presented. And this was a randomized trial of patients who had fixed, according to physical exam, clinical T3 or T4 rectal cancer. It was a randomized phase 3 trial. The other thing that was part of this is that the patients also received oxaliplatin. So the so-called control group, and I'm saying so-called, received, since oxaliplatin was not standard, received 5-FU bolus. They also received oxaliplatin without 5-FU, which would not be considered standard, together with a American or mostly Western European way of giving radiation over 28 fractions. This was then followed by 5-FU and oxaliplatin prior to surgery. What they called the control arm was this short course, 5 high doses, 5x5 grays of radiation up front, followed by FOLFOX. Now, these were not, there were differences in how much chemotherapy patients got, but I think the most important thing about this is that, one, patients tended to do well no matter what you did. Most patients had an R0 resection, meaning that there was no microscopic disease left behind. Most people were able to go to surgery. Few people had metastatic disease at the time of surgery. Now, they also followed patients, even though this is a relatively small trial, but the, you know, patients who were on the 5x5 arm actually had slightly better overall survival, but once again, there were differences in the amount of chemotherapy that they ended up getting. But I think what you can say from this is that the American way of doing it and the Western European way of doing it, which is expensive, takes a long time with radiation, also delays surgery and can also delay chemotherapy to a certain extent, that is not necessarily better. And there is a trial called Rapido that's a large multinational multi-center trial that's being done that will look in a more head-to-head comparison as whether or not we can get away with fewer radiation treatments and end up with at least as good outcome. Now, the other rectal trial that was presented was an update of the Accord 12 trial from the Prodige group, a French group. And this has been presented before. And just to briefly go over, patients had T3 to T4 NX rectal tumors, a large trial, almost about 600 patients. They were randomized to 2 groups that were not necessarily apples to apples. One group got standard capecitabine plus standard 45 gray radiation. The other had a higher dose of radiation together with capecitabine plus oxaliplatin. And this is a follow-up for this. And I think the things that are important is that we already know the local control rate was very similar between the arms. And this is one of the reasons why people don't give oxaliplatin up front. Despite the fact that there was higher radiation given in the so-called experimental arm, there really weren't a large differences. This is more longer-term follow-up with 5-year follow-up, and disease-free survival was very similar, was not statistically significantly different, and there was about a 4 to 5% difference in disease-free survival. So the authors concluded that oxaliplatin led to more toxicity without any significant benefit. And I'm going to just talk for a few minutes about the question about oxaliplatin and rectal cancer. So in stage 3 colon cancer, on the basis of the C07 and the MOSAIC trials, post-operative therapy with generally FOLFOX or perhaps CAPOX has become the standard, though the benefit of adding oxaliplatin to a fluoropyrimidine in disease-free survival is relatively small. In the published studies, that it's really only approximately about 5%, but of course adds significant toxicity. There's also been some retrospective data that patients who are elderly, over the age of 70, may not benefit. So now there have been at least four large trials, the Accord trial, the NSABP R04 trial, a large German trial, as well as a smaller Chinese trial, that have reported out differences in disease-free survival. And what they're showing is that there's really a relatively small improvement in disease-free survival, about 5%, and because people may die of other things, is that none of them have shown an improvement in overall survival. So I would say that even though this is the standard and is in the NCCN guidelines, that the benefit of oxaliplatin in rectal cancer is relatively small. And as to, you know, to finish up about rectal cancer, I think that we will also probably see perhaps some changes in the way that we give radiation therapy. So next, I would actually like to briefly talk about two abstracts that were presented. Both of them are really sort of jumping off points to talk about things that are really very exciting and very interesting in colorectal cancer. The first one was an abstract by Hickey, from Georgetown, who in collaboration with Caris, who is a company that does multi-gene analysis of tumors, looked at differences between older patients and younger patients. And really what I wanted to talk about and this has been in the news recently, there's a paper that will be coming out soon in Cancer that ended up getting a certain amount of press, is that we think of colorectal cancer as an older person's disease, and the vast majority of them, of the patients who get this, are over the age of 50. Now, over the last decade or more, the incidence of colorectal cancer has gone down. I would like to think that it's due to screening with colonoscopy. Some of it may be changes in diet or exercise, but the incidence definitely is going down. There is one subgroup, however, where the incidence is actually rising, which is unusual about any of the major malignancies, and those are younger patients, particularly under the age of 40. Now, when we think of patients who are younger, we specifically think of people with inherited predispositions, such as Lynch syndrome. These patients tend to have right-sided cancers and often have a family history. Familial polyposis is an even smaller group of patients. But what we're seeing now is we're seeing a lot, particularly in academic centers like you know, here at UCLA, is that we're seeing a large number of patients with distal cancers, rectosigmoid, who have no family history, who do not have Lynch syndrome, who do not have abnormalities in DNA mismatch repair. And it's really unclear why this is happening, whether it's environmental or whether or not there are genes that we just have not been able to test for. Now, in this abstract, they looked at, which I found, especially considering there were multiple looks at many different genes, relatively small differences between older and younger patients. But I think this is a field where we're going to be seeing a lot more research in the next couple of years. And I think it's really incumbent on primary care physicians to realize that when a patient has symptoms, particularly change in bowel habits or rectal bleeding, that's not ascribed to hemorrhoids, that people who are under 40 can have colorectal cancer as well. And finally, I'd like to just talk about two trials in progress that were presented at the meeting. Both of them are based on using a PD-1 antibody in colorectal cancer. Deng Li presented at ASCO last year really phenomenal results in patients who have abnormal DNA mismatch repair. Now, many of these patients have inherited predispositions or Lynch syndrome, but up to 15% of all colorectal cancer patients have abnormal DNA mismatch repair, and about 3% of patients with metastatic disease have this. Now, in general, colorectal cancer has not really been invited to the immunotherapy party, unfortunately. And what we've seen is multiple negative cohorts with really no benefit, so very different than lung cancer or melanoma or even to a certain extent gastric cancer. However, in this small group of patients, there was a 90% disease control rate and about a 65% chance of long-term benefit. So what these two trials are, one for previously treated, another one actually in untreated patients for this very small subgroup that In this case, the drug is pembrolizumab, but an anti-PD-1 may actually be as effective as chemotherapy and may lead to long-term benefit. The final question is, what do we do with the other 97% of people? And there are a large number of trials, some of which we're doing, for example, with oncolytic viruses, but other agents trying to get an immune response to patients who have what's called microsatellite stable or no loss of DNA mismatch repair, the vast majority of patients with colorectal cancer. So this was an interesting meeting. I think that the studies that were presented are provocative, and to a certain extent, particularly the FOLFOX versus FOLFIRI may change some people's practice, but most of this hopefully will be setting up for studies in the future. Thank you very much.
You have been listening to CME on ReachMD. To earn your CME credit, please proceed to take the post-test and evaluation, or if you're listening to this as a podcast, go to ReachMD.com/CME.